So I'm going to take the monitor's prerogative of introducing the panel and then a little bit of background information. So you may notice from your program that Dr. Karen Kost is not with us today. She's unable to attend for illness reasons, but not to worry. We have plenty of experts on the podium, and I think we're going to be able to provide you with some interesting cases, hopefully with take-home messages that you can take back to your practices. So I'm from Pittsburgh, Steve Parnes from Albany, Mark Bennett from Vanderbilt, Bob Sadeloff from Drexel, and there's actually no pertinent disclosures to the topics of this panel. So a little bit on why does this matter? Well, we don't have really time to talk in detail about the demographics, but you've all read this in both the professional and the lay literature. I think some interesting figures are that worldwide there will be a 1 billion out of like a 9 billion population in 2020, 2 billion in 2050, so essentially doubling the number of elderly in a 30-year time span. And everybody who will turn 65 in 2050 is alive today. In 2008, the Institute of Medicine published a report, actually their second report on the topic, pointing out that the bottom line is there is a crisis and it's too late to stop it, meaning there are insufficient number of providers specifically trained to handle geriatric issues in the older population. So each of us, except of course if we're pediatric otolaryngologists, each of us will be facing these patients and their unique issues in the years to come. And it's actually the driving force behind a number of educational initiatives, including the AB Otto competencies, of which Michael Johns is working on to assist in developing standard competencies expected of all otolaryngologists in the management of older patients. Here's two frightening graphs. This is the overall world population. You can see skyrocketing, primarily due to improvements in public health as well as improvements in medical care. And here's age of workers in Europe. You can see why we're having so much financial issues in all developed countries. We have fewer workers supporting more older people. And I'm proud to be a member of one of those older people that you younger people are going to be supporting here in the perhaps not so distant future.
Thank you, Mark.
So here's the graph you all may have seen before, the so-called python swallowing the pig or the squaring of the pyramid. Here are the baby boomers down here, baby boomers there, baby boomers here. So you end up with a disproportionate number of older individuals. Whoops, back up. How do I back this thing up here? Right click. Previous. So, except for pediatric otolaryngology, our practices will change. We will have more and different diseases in our patients. So they're come with more problems and they're different problems. And they will have different goals, where independence and functional ability will trump the duration of their survival. We'll have more people involved in the care decisions. There'll be more team decisions than individual decisions. And there is a wider variability in the older population. There's no growth chart for the elderly. A 2-year-old looks pretty much like another 2-year-old, but a 72-year-old does not look like another 72-year-old. So I'll take a little opportunity here for a political announcement. There's an online textbook that's available on the online website, and Bob Sadeloff, who is the current chair of the Academy Geriatric Committee, is working with committee members to rewrite and update that textbook. There's another textbook published by Karen Calhoun and several others, published some years ago on geriatrics. There's American Society for Geriatric Otolaryngology, which actually meets in conjunction with, but not as part of, COSM. Next meeting will be on Thursday night, April 11th, and Jim Sun has agreed to be our guest speaker this year. So with no further ado, I'm going to turn the podium over to Mark Bennett. It's important to note that with only one relatively small exception, none of us have seen the cases of others. So we're going to query each other, and we may ask for some help from the audience as well. So, Mark.
Great. Today I was going to talk a little bit about aging in the elderly and talk a little bit about cochlear implantation and some of the controversies we all see as this goes forward. And I guess the first thing is, how many people in the audience do cochlear implants? Great. Well, that's going to help. And we're going to ask for some interaction, and I'm going to do it through the just essentially one case presentation and following it over time. So we start with a 50-year-old lady with a 12-year history of hearing loss. Started having difficulty over the last couple of years, never tried a hearing aid, never had ear surgery, and she's slightly bothered by bilateral symmetric tinnitus. Past medical history for some diabetes and some early forgetfulness that her family kids her as early Alzheimer's disease without ever seeing a neurologist or any sort of practitioner for it. We get a physical exam, and it's essentially normal neurologic exam, normal tuning forks, normal eardrums. And we proceed on to an audiogram that shows us this high-frequency 4,000 notch with 100% discrims bilaterally. And this is the point where I ask people, if you got one of these choices or if you got another choice on your own, would you put a hearing aid in her? Would you just observe her? Does anyone do imaging on this for this slight asymmetry with worsening in the left ear? Anyone send her for a cochlear implant workup? I kind of hope not. And does anyone treat her directly for tinnitus? Bob?
I do a comprehensive, possibly arguably excessive neurological workup on all of these people. Every once in a while you find that asymmetry is due to something structural. Not infrequently you find something medical, such as autoimmune inner ear disease, that's treatable. If you find such an underlying cause, that may treat the tinnitus. In the absence of any defined etiology, I would offer tinnitus treatment if it bothers her enough, and I would certainly consider amplification. If her 3,000 hertz is down, she's probably starting to have trouble with consonants. This is that interesting population, even though she's only 50, but she has other stigmata of aging, in which we used to think binaural amplification was always the way to go, and the new data suggests that it actually may be worse than monaural amplification, so I would evaluate that very carefully as part of the hearing aid evaluation if she were symptomatic enough to want to proceed.
Yeah, so we had a long discussion about this asymmetry and whether or not to get an image, and she was pretty reasonable, didn't want to get an image, and we fitted her with hearing aids. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'd like to comment about the asymmetry because, you know, you're always left with that dilemma. I certainly have had patients who have had actually perfectly normal hearing, and they had a vestibular schwannoma only because it was an incidental finding. So clearly those patients are out there. But we're getting more sensitive to how many imaging studies we're going to order. I think it depends also on the patient's presentation. If they clearly have, for example, if the tinnitus was so dominant unilateral, if they had some real balance issues, it might suggest that I get an MRI. But other than that, I probably wouldn't. There are some studies to show that there's a statistical relationship between the asymmetry and the likelihood of having a vestibular schwannoma. It's usually a cutoff of about 20 decibels. That's kind of my rule of thumb.
So in the VA, we have, of course, a large number of older veterans with asymmetric hearing loss, and there's an ongoing controversy on the VA email series as to whether or not we should, and those of you in the audience who are on the VA email list have seen this controversy. It's still ongoing. At what point do you image for asymmetric hearing loss?
You know, I'd like to make two points. Number one, we don't talk about it much, but practice setting and philosophy play into this. I'm a tertiary or quaternary care location for neurotology and for voice, and my philosophy is that people expect to not leave my office without a diagnosis. I tell my residents that if they're out practicing in a community setting, that I would certainly support their not doing imaging on many of the people on whom I do imaging. I think it's reasonable to consider that, and we don't usually talk about it. The other comment is whether age plays heavily into that judgment. And until people get very, very old, I personally am uncomfortable withholding treatment that I would give to a 50-year-old for a 75-year-old who may turn out to be a 100-year-old. And if that person has an acoustic, I certainly want to have the discussion about whether to treat it when the person's 75 and not when the person's 90 and has a big tumor.
So we ended up giving her some hearing aids, and over time her hearing worsens. She's a slight cognitive decline, and now she's using hearing aids with little success. She comes in with an audiogram now that shows worsening of her, especially in the higher frequencies, and now she's got discrimination scores in the mid-30s, or 34 and 28%. And I guess the question is now, does anyone continue to use hearing aids? Do people image her now that there's been this decline, or do we get a workup for a cochlear implant on her? And I guess, Bob, would you image her now? You would image her the first time.
Well, I would have imaged her the first time. But if she'd seen you and then came to me, I'd certainly image her now. I'd also be looking really seriously with those discrim scores for another cause. Autoimmune, a lot of people don't look for until it's very late. But it's there early, before it causes severe loss and this kind of problem. Syphilis, Lyme disease, a lot of other things could cause that, and would very aggressively seek those out and try and treat the discrimination scores.
We actually sent her to ID for a workup for all the infectious diseases and gave her a month of high-dose steroids without a response, to just to see if it was autoimmune. And we imaged her looking for tumors, looking for growths, and obviously this isn't through the IICs, but this shows a diffuse cortical atrophy consistent with some neurologic changes that she has on exam. And we sent her for a cochlear implant workup where, again, she's now 54, so she's not Medicare. She's covered through a private insurer, and she's got AZ Bio scores in the 30s to 40s, and a pure tone average, again, from the audiogram of 35. And so my question is, does it matter if we're going, do we send her for, try to get her approved with a private carrier? Does age matter? Does neurologic status matter? Does the insurance carrier matter?
Well, I don't think the actual age matters. It's a physiologic question, and I'm sure your experience is like mine, that you've operated on people in their 80s for cochlear implants, because it's not a very morbid procedure. It's an outpatient procedure, well tolerated. So it's been shown that this is a procedure that really adds to the quality of life to these individuals. So I don't hesitate to do cochlear implants in elderly patients. So that's not a problem for me. But I don't know if she really qualifies for cochlear based on her thresholds. Probably for Medicare thresholds, she probably would not qualify.
I mean, lucky for us, it wasn't that she was Medicare, but you can see listed for the companies what they list as their qualifications, including the comprehension scores. These are open sentences. And again, Medicare. And the question for her comes up with off-label use. And so I, when we look at off-label use, you know, that's defined through the FDA as a good medical practice with the best interest of the patient, requires us to look at the devices with our best knowledge and judgment. When we look at pharmaceuticals, only 20 to 60% are routinely used off-label. But again, that's a high percentage. If we're going to use these implants for off-label, we have to think we've got to be well-informed, use some scientific rationale, medical evidence, and I guess maintain records of its use and efficacy in these sort of patients. And so I ask if we were going to implant someone like this. She's pretty unhappy with hearing aids. Would you implant her, Bob?
Well, Mark, the question that concerns me most is whether that poor discrimination is peripheral or central. It's, of course, hard to sort out. I'd want to do central auditory testing on her and probably a formal cognitive evaluation. But if her neurologic deterioration is the reason why she's not understanding words, then cochlear implants aren't going to help her all that much. If that's really all peripheral, then it still seems a little early, but if all else fails, I would consider doing one ear.
We did do a normal ABR just to show some normal central pathways, but again...
Did you do central auditory processing tests?
She had central auditory processing that was borderline normal, put it that way.
Can I interject a question here? At what stage does one employ central auditory testing? Because there seems to be more and more evidence that that plays a major role in a patient's ability to be rehabilitated.
Well, ever since I've been in practice, I've done it almost routinely when I ask people, first of all, when people complain of hearing impairment that seems worse than I would expect from their audiogram. And one of the key questions is, when you study or read, do you do it with a television or radio on, or do you need quiet places? If you're trying to concentrate or read and somebody talks next to you or turns on a vacuum cleaner, does it interfere with your ability to concentrate and read? And you get that as a yes at all ages, from pediatric patients through the elderly. You see that happen following head trauma in people who haven't had it before. So we've been doing central auditory testing whenever we've clinically suspected a central auditory dysfunction for more than 30 years and found it very helpful. If nothing else, I mean, often you can help these people, but if nothing else, you can at least explain to them what the problem is, get them out of work environments where they're in a pool without sound dividers, get a work modification and have them put in a quiet room instead of a noisy room. For kids, you can have classroom modification, you can have home modification, so they're not trying to do homework in a room with four siblings, and it makes a huge difference. I mean, we've all seen people who come in and say, I can't hear, and you get a normal audiogram. Well, they don't have normal hearing. They have a normal audiogram. They have abnormal hearing somewhere else in the pathway. And it's certainly common. I don't think we have evidence that it's more common. It probably is. But it's certainly common in the elderly. And we have to look for it, because if we put all of our concentration peripherally and when the sound gets to the ascending pathway, it's distorted, we're not addressing the problem.
I guess, how many people in the audience do central processing or central auditory testing? So a fair number. When we looked at her, we actually sent her to neurology, who essentially found some mild dementia, essentially a normal physical exam, a mild tremor, and started on Exelon, which is a cholinesterase inhibitor. And even though she went on to get a cochlear implant, her family is actually much happier that we sent her on to neurology and started on treatment for her early Alzheimer's. There's obviously a strong association that's coming out now between hearing loss and dementia. Frank Lin and the Baltimore study showed some co-linking between them. It could be possibly just overdiagnosis, these patients with dementia getting more medical exams, but it could be the same process or a relationship. And they sort of highlighted a relationship where hearing loss leads to communication impairment, social isolation, which further leads to dementia, which further causes hearing loss and forms this sort of positive feedback circle. There was a New York Times blog this week about the same sort of hearing loss and dementia co-relationships. I guess I'll ask the audience, when we look at, these are the cochlear implant evaluation, better in the right ear. How many people would implant the left ear here, the worst hearing ear? Couple. How many people would implant the right ear, the better hearing ear?
Well, I would have done the worst. In this case, the worst hearing ear, although I guess I would have been conservative at first. It's not the kind of patient that you have an obvious indication for a cochlear implant. And I would ask you, what does the evidence show that in this scenario, how much better are you going to do with a cochlear implant in the face of poor discrimination but reasonable thresholds?
Well, I'll get to that in a second here. But interestingly enough, when the same Baltimore study looked at outcomes, when they looked at all comers, the scores were always better post-implantation. But when you took just the better performing, so these are patients in the marginal, essentially off-label use, they all had a much higher response post-implantation than the people in general. And so there might be a use to implanting the better hearing ear, but we, again, implanted the worst hearing ear, saving the better ear for other days.
Well, the other thing, it depends also on the patient. Sometimes patients still feel that in their better hearing ear, they still have some benefit from their hearing aid. That's another deciding factor which you're going to choose in this scenario.
And when we were talking to her, we were looking at, does age really matter? And should we wait and watch and give her a hearing aid? And this is an increase in HIND scores after implantation. And you can see there's a negative correlation as time goes on. Now, part of this is central processing, like we talked about. But again, if we wait longer, there's a chance that she would perform poorer on the overall. Yeah, Bob?
One of the other things that we find useful in trying to make these tough calls is to remember that most people who get hearing aids don't get much in the way of auditory rehabilitation, and people who get cochlear implants get very intensive hands-on training. So in these cases, we put hearing aids on people and give them the same kinds of intensive hands-on training that they would get after an implant. And often their hearing aid performance goes up a notch or two, and we end up not implanting them. So when you're comparing hearing aids and implants, you really have to think about the missing rehab component with most hearing aid users.
Is there data to support that? Because that makes a lot of sense, but I don't read the otology literature.
I don't know of any. Do you, Mark?
Mm-mm. Not that I know.
I was going to say that also in choosing, as you know, one of the biggest variables that has a correlation is duration of hearing loss in deciding which, you know, how well a patient will do. Right. And in fact, etiology seems to be of less a concern. So the longer the hearing loss, the worse the result. So that's another deciding factor which ear to choose.
And I guess the last question is, does the insurance carrier matter? I'm sorry. Yes, please.
A question, please. Actually directed to Bob Sadoff, Mark Persky from New York. Bob, earlier you stated that a patient coming to you in a large, well-known medical center certainly warrants a diagnosis, and you would probably do imaging studies.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Can you come
sure.
Just a shade closer?
You stated that a patient coming to you in a large, well-known academic medical center certainly deserves imaging studies to establish a diagnosis. And yet, you also stated that patients perhaps in a smaller community may not warrant that imaging study to establish a diagnosis for the same presentation. And I just wonder how you justify that.
Make clear what I said. I understand the question. If I have somebody with a 10 or 15 decibel asymmetry in the high frequencies, I study that. People could argue that that's not cost-effective. It certainly isn't from the standpoint of the insurance company, but that's not how I define cost-effectiveness. So I would study that person. If my former resident practicing in Lancaster had somebody come in with a 15 decibel asymmetry at 6 and 8,000 hertz and said, well, we'll follow you again in 6 months, and did not do an MRI, I think that's perfectly appropriate practice. You know, it's not what I would do, but I think that it's another right thing to do. So that's the point I was trying to make. I can't sleep at night with anybody leaving my office undiagnosed. I find some things earlier than other people find them, but I certainly order more negative studies than other people. And what I was saying is that's what I do, that's the way I practice in my setting, but I don't think that that means that that's the standard of care.
Dr. Rubin?
Yeah, hi, Al Rubin from Toledo, Ohio. I got two questions. One, coming from the Canadian system where there isn't a lot of money and we don't do MRIs and everybody has a slight asymmetry, don't you think just doing a brainstem testing initially, which would have shown that it's normal, I know that the MRI is the gold standard, would have been sufficient in this case considering the SCRIM scores were all normal. So that's why I dare to differ with Bob. I think that was not the time to do an MRI. That's my first question, just with the brainstem being normal, then maybe repeating it later on.
Let's answer that one first.
Go ahead.
I published a paper on that with a former resident named Rich Schmidt several years ago, looking at ABR, I think it may even be in archives, I don't remember, it was a while ago, looking at ABR abnormality in small tumors, and you miss a substantial percentage of tumors under a centimeter and a half that have false normal ABRs. Now you may say, and maybe the Canadian system says, that's okay, maybe you don't want to operate on a tumor that's a centimeter or a centimeter and a half, but I don't agree with that. So that's why I don't like ABR screening. You pick up most of the big tumors, but you have a lot of small tumors with normal ABRs.
Can I take the moderator's prerogative and cut this discussion? Because I don't think we're going to come to a conclusion on this. So, Al, you got one more question.
Just one more question. Would it be worthwhile, and I don't know the answer to this, because you've had bilateral sensorineural hearing loss, to also look at the vestibular system?
There were no complaints from a vestibular system standpoint, but looking for vestibular loss, I mean, she didn't have on exam. We do a pretty comprehensive, the head thrust, head shake, all those things. They were all completely normal.
So thank you, Mark. And we're called to the podium now. Steve Parnes is going to present his case. And once again, the panelists, with one small exception, have never seen this case before.
Is it a right place to advance it?
It should be more on this side.
Yeah, I'd left.
This should be Parnes' slides.
Yeah, there we go. All right, so I'm going to talk about a case, a patient who presented with facial paralysis. So this is a 78-year-old male, and he came with the diagnosis of Bell's palsy, which is very common from primary care doctors, since every patient with a facial paralysis is considered Bell's palsy. And he had this Bell's palsy for 5 months, gradual onset. He had had an MRI, and that was negative. There wasn't much else to the history. His past history had some hypothyroidism, chicken pox, infectious mono. He's on Synthroid. He had no known allergies. On his exam, he was very alert, oriented, and he had a complete paralysis on the right side. The remainder of his exam, cranial nerves were intact. The neurologic exam was normal. His gait was normal. And basically, his ear exam was normal. Tuning fork testing was normal. And we assumed his hearing was normal at that point. So at this point, I'll open up to the panel or the audience as what would you do next?
So I guess my first question is, did the MR, was it an MR of the brain, or did it include the parotid gland? Because in the world I live in, this is parotid tumor until proven otherwise, and I have frequently encountered patients just like this who arrived with an MR scan and the parotid was not visualized on the MR.
Well, we didn't have access to that MRI. It was just a written comment that it was normal. But I agree that I would suspect that the MRI might not have been totally accurate.
I think the other thing is that it's a leap of faith just to look at a report sometimes on an MRI. And we sort of mandate that everyone send us the films because on average I'll pick up 5 to 10 abnormalities that are missed on a yearly basis. That's a high number. If we just took the reports all the time, I think we'd be lost.
Yeah, and there are abnormalities and normalities missed. I still see a ridiculous number of those films that come in with 6-millimeter cuts, and the IACs aren't there at all. So they were correct in reading no abnormality seen, but with no IAC seen, it sort of...
Right, and I have to agree, this is not a typical presentation of a Bell's palsy. I think we all understand that this is a typical presentation of a tumor. At least it sounds like it, or something else. Is there any other studies you might want to consider?
I think I'd want to look at the MRI first, but I'd be thinking about a CT, looking at the facial nerve through the temporal bone, looking for dilations and abnormalities.
And I agree that's where I would go first, but I also look for Lyme disease and medical causes, heavy metals, things like that where appropriate.
Okay. Well, we did get a Lyme test. It was negative. Actually, we repeated the MRI this time in our institution. It was normal. And we did an EMG, and it showed a right lower motor neuron facial paralysis. You can see there's no activity on the right side. So the question is, what do you do with this gentleman at this time?
So how's his general health? Is he a healthy gentleman who would withstand surgery, or is he a frail individual who's not likely to do well after surgery?
He's actually quite healthy at this point. No issues there. And any else? Any other concerns?
This is how old?
He's 78.
No, the paralysis.
Oh, it was 5 months. So at this point, at 5 months, I'm not sure what's going to happen to this gentleman. Is the nerve going to recover? It doesn't look like it, but I'm not certain. But I think the thing to think about, of course, is eye protection, and I think that's the first thing I would think of in doing for these patients. Then the others is somewhat aesthetic considerations.
Is he having trouble with drooling? Is he having trouble eating because of the paralysis?
No, it wasn't that excessive. So in actuality, he made the decision for us to a certain extent. I was very adamant about eye protection, so we did a right eye Goldway, and actually a tarsal strip, not a tarsorrhaphy, and he did pretty well. But we talked about different options, but he really, at this point, he understood that it was unclear why he had the facial paralysis, what may happen. He was willing to wait. He wasn't concerned about the aesthetic problems. So now it's about a year later since I saw him, and I had this anxiety that this nerve's not, his face is not improving, and then we repeated, we got another MRI, in fact. And that, again, was negative for any tumors, but it did show some problems in the mastoid, some increased signal. His tinnitus, he started to develop some tinnitus, but bilateral, but he started to develop a hearing loss on the right side in October. Is there anything would you do differently at this point?
Sensory neural.
Sensory neural was, here's the audiogram, sorry. So it was mostly sensory neural on the right side. The left side shows a typical pattern for someone his age.
First thing would be a repeat MR.
We just had an MRI several months ago.
Wouldn't be the first time it had missed something. But, yeah. I mean, I would worry about that change.
So he's had three normal MRIs.
I'm sorry, and the mastoid shows...
It was just fluid, actually. Just fluid in the mastoid. And in fact, on exam, he obviously had fluid in the ear as well. There was a small conductor component, so we decided to at least put a tube in the ear. I did not order an MRI at this time because I guess I already had three MRIs that were normal. And I thought it's a year since his... It's over a year. It's about a year and a half now. It was pretty certain at this point his face was not going to return. And he was more receptive to having some type of procedure for his face. So now I open up to the panelists about what to discuss with this patient.
What do you think is going on? If he's got a facial paralysis and a progressive asymmetric sensory neural hearing loss, I understand.
Well, obviously, I'm always concerned this man has tumor. And every discussion I had with this gentleman, I said, you know, I think you have a tumor and we've just been unable to find it.
I think I might PET CT him. I mean, it's not a typical thing we do in otology, but I think this is a tumor till proven otherwise. This is the things that my mentors talk about, just taking to the OR and exploring the facial nerve from the brainstem out.
So this is where this question of age and frailty come in. I mean, you say this man looks pretty healthy. Do you do any formal testing for frailty in elderly, in your older population? Do you look at walking speed or hand grip strength or anything that?
Well, on each exam that I see this gentleman, he always undergoes a limited neurologic exam in my office. We always check to see his balance. We look at his cranial nerves, if he can do a tandem Romberg, for example, especially with his eyes closed. He was still able to do those things in my office. So I agree with the panel. I think that the tumor likely is a strong possibility, but we, I guess, have the comfort of, well, we already have three MRIs, and that we should just think about what to do to help this gentleman at this point. So now I open up, Bob, is there any suggestions you have as what procedure you would choose, regardless of what the cause is? I think something needs to be done. He's interested in some procedure.
I would lean toward reanimation rather than reinnervation, probably, just to avoid adding another neurologic deficit to him while we don't know what's going on. I'm not sure I would do a 12. I mean, you might do a split 12-7, but I probably would consider a static procedure more conservative.
W. Mark.
Given his age, we'd think about static. We also started doing masseteric nerve transpositions so that leaves less of a deficit.
Dave, do you have any?
So I haven't done this for quite a few years, but I would certainly favor a static sling because it's much less of an extensive procedure. And he's 80 years old, and your goals are to allow him to intervene in the or to interact with the public and his friends, but not necessarily try to restore his normal appearance or close to normal appearance.
And I would agree with that because particularly you want results more immediate, especially in someone his age. So we did a
temporalis muscle flap. In him, I did a little different approach. We used the tendon side of the temporalis muscle. We were able to harvest it at the coronoid process, and we used a fasciolatic graft. And he had a very nice, I thought, aesthetic result from the temporalis muscle flap procedure. But we continue to follow him. And although he had a nice aesthetic result, he himself slowly went downhill. He started to get more hearing loss, and ultimately he started to have rapid decline in mental status and weakness. So all of your remarks about getting an MRI scan were correct. So despite the fact having three normal MRIs prior to this, he had a massive tumor at the base of the skull on this particular encounter. And it was clear that this was the original problem. It's surprising to me that a tumor of this size could not have been seen on previous MRIs, but I think in retrospect, if we had gotten the MRI when he started to get the unilateral hearing loss, we probably would have picked something up back then. So now what do you do with this gentleman?
You'd say he's developed significant cognitive decline.
He's cognitive decline. He's really deteriorated considerably.
So does this individual have a family physician that he's close to, that with her primary care physician that he that knows him and communicates with him and his family, or are you sort of his de facto physician?
Mostly he was dependent on myself and the people at the medical center, less dependent on his primary care physician. So we were making decisions for him and helping with his, also with his family, making those decisions.
He was in good shape. He's got quality of life issues. I would want to get histopathology. This is, if you don't mess up the vein of Labay, this is not a hard area to get to. I would go in with a neurosurgeon, find out what this is, potentially debulk it, and see if he can, once you know what you're dealing with, treat him.
What would you do, Mark?
I actually would probably, in that location, I think you get it by going through the tegmen and taking a bite and repairing it with a piece of cartilage and save them any sort of intracranial craniotomy. I might try to get a piece from below and send it without doing anything too aggressive and just see again what the pathology shows. Because it's going to make a lot of difference if it's something, I'm assuming this is not anything that's benign that's popped up over 12 months to 5 centimeters.
So it's been my impression that in these kinds of cases, the if we should do something is a greater question than what to do. And oftentimes families are not, and this gentleman is probably no longer able, am I correct in my assumption, he's no longer able to take an active role in the decision making alone, but requires his family. And families are not always ready to come to a conclusion. So I think these are very difficult decisions. Should we do something in this gentleman with an advanced tumor that is has suffered cognitive decline?
Yes. But we have
Chris
no
Gordon
idea what this
Baltimore.
Is.
Sorry, Chris Gordon, I just have to share some thoughts. So one is, you mentioned, you know, somebody asked, does he have a family physician? We are seeing a decrease in the number of family physicians, which unfortunately we need more, not less, as the population ages. Increasingly, these patients come to us and they ask us what to do. So I find in my practice, which is oncology, it's pretty unusual for a family or patient to tell me what their wishes are. They ask us what to do. So as I hear these different approaches being discussed, how to get this or even get a piece of this, you know, there's a great institution and organization called Hospice and Palliative Care Medicine that when you describe an 80-year-old who's pretty functional but has gone downhill significantly, the literature suggests he's not going to recover to his baseline status even if this is a treatable lesion. So I think that we have to incorporate some non-aggressive methods of counseling patients as well as treating patients in the very elderly population.
Well, I think you make a very good point. As a physician, you're anxious to do something for your patient. You want to make a diagnosis. But in reality, he was fairly deteriorated. The diagnosis was never made. It was assumed it might be a meningioma. I'm not certain of that since it suddenly became so aggressive. Actually, there was no active intervention, just supportive care, and he actually expired a few months after that decision. So I think that was, in this case, the appropriate thing to do for this gentleman.
Paul Friedlander from New Orleans. And we do work with the faith.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, Paul Friedlander with New Orleans. And again, one area to look outside of the family practitioners, also spiritual counselors for the patient, because again, these end-of-life decisions are often not medical but spiritual. And to realize that people have different people they turn to, not necessarily their physician.
I have a question for the audience. Those of you that are involved in resident training, how many of you have residency training programs that help your trainees learn how to discuss end-of-life decision-making with families? How many of you do that actively? So some. I'm going to suspect that this is going to become a greater part of what we all do with our trainees, is help them in rehearsing and practicing these kinds of decision-making. Question.
Is this on?
Yes.
You can hear me?
Yes.
The answer to your question right now is yes, we discuss this a lot. The other thing is, I had a patient just like this, blew me away, and we couldn't find anything on this guy with multiple images over time, and then one day, bam, he showed up with a lesion looking just like that. And I went over all of the old films with our neuroradiologists, and we just didn't see anything. And then all of a sudden, bam, there it was. He did have an autopsy, and it turned out to be an osteogenic sarcoma. But I still don't understand the pathobiology of how we could not see this. But I think your point, and it applies to all ages, not just to geriatrics, is the patient is a huge part of the communication process. And you know that, but we teach that.
So I'll take the moderator's prerogative to move to our last presentation, which will be Bob Sadaloff presenting his case. And once again, none of the panelists have encountered his case. We start a little bit late, so I'm intending to go a little bit past 10 o'clock. So if you folks have other events to head to, just head on out when you have to leave.
If we can have the next presentation, please. The AV people here? Ah, that looks familiar. Voice disorders in the elderly are not a cosmetic issue. I'm going to chat for a couple minutes, although I'm still shooting to end on time. because I'm presenting a slightly different kind of case today from what we usually talk about. As people age, their voices tend to get softer, they develop tremors, irregularities, and as people listen to elderly people with unstable voices, they infer that the people are intellectually unstable. They lose credibility as their voices lose impact. In addition, voices become softer with age, just as all their friends are going deaf. So communication is impaired. People talk, their friends don't hear them, their friends say what, they say it again, their voices get tired, and they end up just sitting there quiet. We appreciate this with our hearing impaired patients. We all understand the communication isolation of people who won't wear hearing aids. But the same thing happens with people whose voices become soft and unconvincing. So addressing these problems is more than just making people sound good. It is a real quality of life issue. In the last few presentations on this topic at ASGO and at the Academy and elsewhere, we've talked about the most common problem, which is failure of glottic closure. There are several ways to address these issues. Exercise is one. Aerobic reconditioning under medical supervision, vocal retraining helps eliminate some of the instabilities in the voice and often improves glottic closure. When we proceed to surgery, the most common surgery for aging voices is medialization, so that with minimal effort, instead of having faulty contact, people have redundant contact. Then without working, they get good volume and they function better. Today's case is not one of my standard cases with pictures of people singing in operas and doing services afterwards. But I wanted to talk about two issues today. Actually, Mark beat me a little bit on one of them. We often talk about physiologic age with reference to people who are 80 who seem to be 45. We think less about physiologic age in people who are 50 who seem to be 80. This patient was 52 years old. He had had a weak voice for 10 years. He also had benign prostatic hypertrophy, hypertension. He was 52 years old, and he already had cardiac stents implanted. He was geriatric in all ways. Now, he had been treated elsewhere. This was a very prominent businessman who owns a chain of fast food restaurants throughout the Midwest. He had been treated by an otolaryngologist in the Midwest who had tried gel foam injection and then had given radius injections, hydroxylapatite, on three occasions and got somewhat satisfactory results with the fourth, and then had a fourth radius injection trying to make him even better and made him a lot worse. And the reason I wanted to talk about this case is to highlight the fact that although we think of medializations as fairly routine procedures, they are not without hazard. This is, as this gentleman appeared when he presented in Philadelphia after his fourth radius injection and a prolonged period of dysphonia after that fourth injection.
As long as you can. As long as you can.
You can see that there is hydroxylapatite under the margin. Both sides are stiff. There's a groove on this side, and I'm going to play it again. You'll notice the left vocal fold, rather than being pliable, moves as a block. And if those of you who share my gray hair think back to some of your Teflon patients, you will find this not a very different...
As long as you can. As long as you can.
Now, there's several different components of voice complaint. One of them is voice quality. Another is audibility. Another is effort. When you have bilateral opposing stiffness, phonation threshold pressures are high. And in addition to all the other problems that people have with their voices, they have to work in order to phonate. So clearly this kind of result makes people worse than they were to start with, and it's not easy to deal with. I present this because there's not a lot of literature out there on the problems associated with hydroxylapatite. We published this and several other cases recently. When the physician in the Midwest did this for this gentleman, which started around 2006, there was no literature experience to tell him he was doing the wrong thing. All of us might have made the same mistakes. He did not violate the standard of care. There was very limited experience with this material. But as we've learned more, it's important to recognize that bad things happen. Now, in addition to perhaps aging changes, muscle bulk, this person had what appeared to be weakness in the left superior laryngeal nerve. We find laryngeal EMGs very useful, but you have to be careful with them in people who've had surgery or trauma. If you inject something into the thyroarytenoid muscle, or if you have a traumatic episode, even intubation, and bleed into the muscle, you get fibrosis in that muscle, and you have a decreased recruitment response that's due to mechanical muscle dysfunction and not to improper innervation. So you have to make sure when you interpret these EMGs that you have data from other uninvolved muscles, like the posterior cricoarytenoid muscle. And when we restudied this person, it turned out that his neurologic function was just fine. He just had a decreased electrical response because the needle was sitting in hydroxyl apatite rather than muscle. Very easy to get a false impression. This is one of several images, and you can see that his vocal fold on this side is essentially replaced right up to the vibratory margin. There were some nice coronals, too, that went from supraglottic to infraglottic with radius, less of a problem on the other side. But over-injection is a real problem. So you now have somebody who is functionally elderly, has a weak voice, now has an effortful voice, has hoarseness and disruption. It is not unsalvageable because of time. Well, does the panel want to comment on anything before I show you what we did and wrap it up?
So I take it from your history that this gentleman is a heavy voice user. He owns a chain of restaurants, has to speak frequently to his managers and supervisors. And so he's that performer, if you will.
He is very much a professional voice user. He's a businessman whose bottom line looks considerably better than ours ever will. There's a lot of public relations involved. He has a young, gorgeous wife. He's very much socially and professionally a young person and very active, heavy voice user. And this has been a major impairment for him.
Well, actually, it's easier for me to decide what to do. I have Stan Shapshay down the hall. I just send them there. But I don't know what the literature is in terms of how to reverse this difficult problem. I don't know if you treat it similarly to the Teflon injected patients.
You know, some of us in the room remember trying to remove Teflon, and it doesn't go well.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And in the paper that we published on this that included this case among others, although hydroxyl apatite is much like bone and is supposed to be non-reactive and usually is fine, there are a small number of patients who develop histopathology and clinical pathology that is indistinguishable from a Teflon granuloma. And we have histology published in that paper. And if you looked at it, you'd say that's a Teflon granuloma, except you don't see the Teflon particles. So it can happen, and that was part of the point here. Like Teflon, you can, in fact, excise it to a point. Here you see an incision, the radius being exposed in this huge block of radius. I did not use the laser in this like we used to use laterally on the Teflon because it was way too close to the vibratory margin to cook everything. The radius was debulked. Like Teflon, you never get it out completely, but unlike Teflon, it resorbs over time. So several years later, when you do a CT scan, there's no radius there, and it's not because I took it all out. This, of course, created glottal insufficiency again. So once he had healed, and I gave him a year, I did a bilateral thyroplasty. And 4 years after it was all over, he looked about the same way as he did 6 months after the thyroplasty. So you see improvement in pliability, better but not perfect glottic closure. His increased effort had resolved completely. His phonation times were much longer. His volume is better. He might benefit from slightly more medialization, but neither he nor I is particularly anxious to take him back to the operating room. So I will turn to your greatest in-house asset and see what Dr. Shapshay has to say back there.
Well, great result. It's a very difficult case. I just wanted to share with you, I've taken a lot of Teflon out over the years in the past, and I've taken some radius out too. I agree. Both can be difficult. Teflon in particular, with the granulation tissue. But I would never use a laser on Teflon because for two reasons. If anybody has Teflon problem, I don't think they're occurring very often anymore, but it will make this Teflon glow and really heat it up, and you'll have tremendous thermal effects with the laser. The other thing is if it's an immediate injection, it's flammable. You'll cause a fire with fresh Teflon. Secondly, the radius, when I've gone back to remove radius, oftentimes it's liquefied. You have little cystic areas, and this is an immediate removal of radius. I've not seen the calcified and long-term effects of similar to Teflon, so this is quite interesting. But I've also seen people who absorb radius. We've done a couple of people who are radius absorbers, and it's not in the literature. You inject it in a very good position, deep in the muscle, and suddenly it's gone over a period of months. I wonder if you've had that experience as well.
Yeah, actually it is in the literature. You can expect if you put in a reasonable amount of radius that in 18 months or 2 years, most or all of it will be gone. But the fibrotic capsules that form around the 40 to 100 micron radius granules will remain and continue to act as medializing spacers. So it's not unusual to have radius go away. When it was first introduced, and as we all know, it was introduced based on a prior device that's not truly comparable, and it was FDA approved before there had been any human trials. So we're still finding out about it. When it was first introduced, people thought it was permanent. The medialization may be permanent, but the hydroxyl apatite usually is not permanent. And I have had the same experience. I've seen still liquid radius. I've seen still liquid Teflon. I'm sure you have too. Even sometimes many years out, you open up a block of Teflon and you can actually suck out some Teflon on the inside. But what happens less commonly in these cases is not liquid. It's all stuck and scarred in, just like the Teflon granulomas occasionally. So we need to treat these people. They need good voice therapy. They need good medialization. We need to take seriously these voice problems because they can be as troubling to quality of life as a hearing impairment. But we need to remember that nothing that we do is necessarily benign.
Thank you, Bob. And we're about 5 minutes over, so we'll go ahead and close the panel. The panelists will be up here if someone wants to come up and ask any further questions or offer any further comments. Thank you.